Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to welcome back Molly Fifield-Murray, Outreach Programs Manager for the UW Arboretum in Madison. And she knows an awful lot about native plants, sustainable gardening with native plants. She knows a lot about rain gardens. And those are topics we're going to certainly be bringing up today as we visit with her. And I hope you'll join in. Do you have a rain garden, or would you like to have one? If you have one, send us a picture. Put it on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Do you incorporate native plants into your landscape? Why or why not? Those are some things we can talk with you about. And certainly, if you have questions for Molly, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or comment or a photo as well right there. And you'll have to pardon my voice today. I'm still suffering a summer or fall, I guess we could say fall cold. Molly?
Well, you have a week to call it summer, I guess. So.
Another week. It's still a summer cold. Well, it is what it is. We've got, rain gardens, I think, are so cool. They can really be attractive, a great addition to a garden.
They're beautiful if they are planted well, and they do a wonderful service. They help water infiltrate into the ground right where it falls, like it used to, and therefore doesn't run off, doesn't become runoff into the lakes carrying sediment. So it's a great win-win situation.
How would you define a rain garden? What's the definition?
Well, rain gardens are designed to absorb moisture that's falling on hard surfaces, and you direct the water from your roof or your driveway into one of them, and they are built to collect the water, and the plants and their roots allow the water to infiltrate instead of running off.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of plants are good choices for Wisconsin rain gardens?
Well, if it's a sunny situation, it's wet prairie plants down in the wettest part. You know, the idea of rain gardens is for the water to infiltrate quickly. So it's not a standing water situation. It's not mosquito breeding situation. But it's beautiful plants like cardinal flower or blue lobelia or marsh marigolds in the spring in the wettest part, even iris, the wild iris, the blue flag. And then, of course, parts of the rain garden are not wet because they're the bank that's on the downslope side or something
sure.
like that.
And I would think during the, and I have to say we don't have a rain garden, wish we did, and maybe we will have. I've certainly thought about it. What does it look like through the season? What happens to a rain garden through the various seasons?
Well, it looks like a perennial garden. But it's designed with plants that have root systems that penetrate the ground deeply, either tap roots like in swamp milkweed, or rhizomatous roots that help the water penetrate. So it's not much that different looking than a perennial garden, although it will have some grasses in it, some sedges in it to help the plants. Grasses in a prairie garden and a rain garden in the sun is a prairie garden help the forbs, the flowering, yeah. showy flower plants, help them to stay sort of well-behaved because the grasses in the root zone compete. It's not a matter of holding them up. It's not a matter of holding up New England aster, for instance, but it is a matter of competing with it underground so that it doesn't get 6 feet tall and fall over, which is a frequent problem in a perennial garden that doesn't have the grasses in it.
Yeah. Is it a lot of work to put one in?
No more work than any other garden. And the maintenance can be mulched. You know, you can put in plants and then mulch around them and then watch for weeds either that have come in from the mulch. You are disturbing the ground to create a rain garden because you're excavating a certain amount of distance to hold the water long enough for it to penetrate instead of running off.
And I know rain, I'm sure we're going to get questions about rain gardens, but I also wanted to to mention that we have a native gardening conference coming up, and certainly you are quite in favor of native landscaping and gardening with native plants.
Well, it's becoming more and more obvious as to why it's a nice thing to do as well as a necessary thing to do. One of the things that's interesting right now, and I'm learning lots more about, are native pollinators. And native plants are very important for them, not only for them to get nectar, but to provide food for the larva. For instance, if you want butterflies, you can plant non-native plants for them to nectar on, but the larva won't eat them. So you have to think about the whole system. So the Native Gardening Conference, Evelyn Hayden is going to talk about that. She's our keynote address at the Garden Conference. But there's also the Midwest expert on sedges speaking and having a workshop, Andrew Hipp. And sedges are just coming into their own. You know, when we started into native plant plantings maybe 30, 35 years ago, sedges were confusing to people and they didn't get used very much, but they're a lot more common now.
Yeah, as we gain more information and more knowledge about them, I guess.
Right.
Molly Fifield Murray, our guest today, talking with her today about gardening with native plants. We're talking about rain gardens with her and certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Question or comment, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org with a question or comment, or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show, and you can post right there. That conference, by the way, we didn't give the date, but it's, was it not this weekend, but
it's on a Sunday, September 18th. And it's all day, 8:45 to 4:30. It's at the Arboretum, so you get a chance to see the native gardens that have been planted in the 4 acres around the visitor center. And they're sort of examples. And then you have a chance to be inside and learn some things from experts.
You know, you should talk a little bit about the UW Arboretum. What a treasure we have. But tell us about the different habitats and gardens that we have there.
Well, in the last 10 years, we've developed these 4 acres of native plant gardens that use the ecosystems that are on the other 1,000 acres of the Arboretum, prairies, savannas, woodlands, as models for the gardens. And so you can come to the visitor center and learn some of the plants, learn how to use the plants in a landscape home situation, and then you can go out and explore the full ecosystem. In addition, there's, of course, the famous Longenecker Gardens, which are about 40 acres of woody plant collection with the most complete crabapple collection in the country and one of the most extensive lilac collections. Yeah. And right now, the hydrangeas are amazing. So
it's any time is really a great time to be out there, frankly. It's
right.
Fun to go even in the wintertime.
Oh, yes. You can ski at the Arboretum. We have 20 miles of trails. Not all 20 are available for skiing because some are very narrow hiking trails. We don't groom the paths either, but if you're interested in old-fashioned cross-country skiing through a nice setting, you can come out. And we have classes and tours year-round. Every Sunday at 1 o'clock, we have a naturalist-guided tour.
Well, Pat in Madison has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Pat. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I live in a very tight neighborhood. It's very, you know, close housing, and we have small lots. And I like the rain garden concept. And what I'd done some years ago is I contoured a garden area because I didn't want to have all the grasses and sedges because I just don't particularly like the look of that. And, you know, a smaller lot, it sort of makes it look cluttered. So what I did was I contoured the ground, and these higher areas that I raised up with some stones and things like that and filled in with soil, I put regular ornamentals in there, things that I have no green thumb, and so like hosta and peony and all of that, you know, you see that, but below it is where the water runs, and so you don't actually see all the grasses. So I'm not a purist, but what do you think of that?
I think people should plant what they love, and I hope people learn to love many of the native plants. But I admit I have peonies at home. They're from my mother's garden. They're ancient, you know, and old roses. The only concern I have about non-native plants are the lack of ecosystem services that they provide which I was just mentioning, you know, the most widely planted tree in the United States is the Norway maple, and it provides no food for native insects or birds. And so while it's providing shade and it's a tree, it's not providing, and it's providing oxygen, of course, but not providing home. Whereas if you plant an oak or a cherry or a hickory or some of the native species, the oaks provide a living for 400 species. So it's a very important concept to think about. But what you've done with your favorite plants in the most visible place and then the utilitarian plants that are helping the water to absorb is, you know, not something I would put a red flag on or anything.
Thank you. I appreciate those insights. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Pat. Jim in Ashland, let's go to you now. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to tell you guys about my rain gardens. I put the first one in along one side of our house about 3 years ago. And then this spring, I put in a second one, and I've got a plan. The second one is on the other side of our house, and I'm planning to put one in back next year. It's all native plants except for a few volunteers that have snuck in, but everything I planted was native plants, and the volunteers are things like the white daisies and the hawkweed that still look nice, even though they're not authentic. But I've got things like wild columbine, boneset, wild strawberries, Rudbeckia, black-eyed Susans, let's see, what else? For grasses, there's a bottle brush grass and some other taller grass. I can't remember what it's called. Right now, just about everything is in bloom, and it's absolutely beautiful.
Oh, man. Sounds great, doesn't it, Molly?
Yes, it sounds beautiful. And, you know, the previous caller had mentioned having a small lot and trying her best to make it attractive. And I think that's a very important thing to remember when you're in an urban situation, that if your neighbors are not accepting of native plants can look like a perennial garden without any problem. And, in fact, many perennial plants are adapted natives that have been selected for a special color or something. But you can use all natives and still have it be very attractive. My daughter lives in the east side of Madison. She has probably the tiniest kind of lot you can have in Madison, and they have a rain garden in the front that, you know, is between the sidewalk and the driveway, but it's collecting the water from the downspout so it's not going into the stormwater system.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
So what this fellow's doing up north is great. You know, you can use any ecosystem, and they don't have to be in the sun. The first rain garden descriptions were all for sunny gardens, but the woodland wildflowers and ferns and all those things are also eligible to be rain garden plants.
Jim, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, shoot us a photo. Put it up on the Facebook page.
That'd be great to
see. I would love to see it. Appreciate it very much. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. If you've got a digital camera, that would be really cool. I would love to see it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post a comment or a photo at our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Our guest today, Molly Fifield-Murray, Outreach Programs Manager for the UW Arboretum in Madison. Brittany DeAnda, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Molly Fifield-Murray. And if you have a question for her as we talk native plants and rain gardens, sustainable gardening, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Lori in Mayville, you are up. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I have a question. We have a lot of native gardening going on in our yard, and we're in a city lot at the bottom of a hill, and we have an area that the water just tends to sit at, mainly in the spring or after a heavy rainfall. And I'm wondering if the typical rain garden plants, or if there are any great ones that you could advise to use in an area like that.
Probably a clay area.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and also accepting water from an awful large area, probably uphill. Well,
right.
Yes, if you look at wet prairie or even sedge meadow kinds of species, they are able to dry out, but they are also able to be underwater for a fairly long time.
Okay.
But you'll probably be surprised once the roots get established that they'll penetrate the clay layer and the water will absorb. So you don't want to plant pond species expecting there always to be water there.
Right.
So, you know, some of the tap-rooted species will penetrate the ground, and then you can have some more of the rhizomatous species. There are some grasses that are quite lovely that can be used, like blue joint grass or rice cut grass or some of those. There are some sedges. But also, you know, just marsh milkweed, iris, cardinal flower, blue lobelia, monkey flower, those are all things that would work in that kind of situation.
Okay, great. I appreciate your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, appreciate it, Lori. John in Wanakee, your turn. Hi, John.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I just wanted to say that we put in a rain garden in our backyard with native plants, mostly to help with lawn drainage.
Mm-hmm.
It works great. The flowers are beautiful, all natural. But we actually then converted all of our traditional gardens in the front and side to act as rain gardens. So they're not, I mean, they're just the normal old plants, the roses and the non-native species. But we put in rain barrels at the downspouts and irrigation tubing so that they're doing the same rain garden function without being native.
Well, that's a great way to do it, and in fact, they're not. It sounds like they're not only not native, but you haven't excavated and you're not holding water there. You're holding it in the rain barrel, and that's
exactly.
Another way to do it is to collect the water in a vessel like the rain barrel, and then let it out slowly to keep your roses well hydrated. You know, like we had a very dry spell this summer, and that would have been perfect.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks, John.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Are rain gardens, is there, you know, like a fall maintenance or any kind of, you know, sort of maintenance that you have to do with a rain garden?
Well, it's like any garden that it requires, you know, monitoring for weeds, and then you'll want to clip them back at some time. Now, so it sort of depends on the situation they're in. At the Arboretum, we let our gardens stand over the winter, so there's food for birds and cover for the insects that are overwintering. And then we clip them off in the spring. Some of them we burn, but you don't need to burn at all. You just need to remove the material in the spring. Eventually, you could start collecting seed or something and share it with neighbors or start another garden with it, or, you know, start them in plants and bring them to the Arboretum plant sale to as a volunteer. So, you know, typical garden things. I tend not to deadhead things. I tend to not want to do a lot of gardening. I like to watch the garden and see what the birds and insects are doing. The birds have been all over the seed heads of things, so there's not much to deadhead in some of the gardens because the goldfinches and chickadees are after the seeds. And that's one of the things I like about gardening is everything else you attract.
And you mentioned seeds and saving seeds, and I believe at the event that you've got coming up that there's something about seed saving, is there not?
That's right. Well, there's a class tomorrow at the Arboretum, but there's also a session at the gardening conference on September 18th that is about collecting native seeds. That's one of the afternoon sessions.
So that's something, and I didn't bring this up before, but is there a cost associated with this?
Yes. The cost is, I think, $60. Let me look. Yes, $60 for the public, $54 for members of the Friends of the Arboretum, and $30 for students.
And that includes lunch?
Or? Yes, that includes lunch.
So pretty reasonable then.
Well, you'd think so.
Yeah. Molly Fifield Murray, our guest today, as we talk with her about native plants. What about the native plants aside from the rain garden? What other? I mean, you like to leave your plants up through the winter?
Yes. You know, I don't think I thought about this kind of thing when I first started out in landscape architecture, but thinking about the other species that you're attracting with your garden plants. And I'm a photographer, and you start taking photos of flowers, and then all of a sudden there's insects in all those flowers, and you have to figure out what they are, and then you see the birds getting the seeds, and you see the butterflies. Today, you know, the fritillaries are out, the monarchs are migrating, the crescents are these tiny little but brilliant orange butterflies coming around, and the hummingbirds are migrating, and so they've been at the thistles. There's a native thistle, a field thistle, that's a beautiful, it's very tall, so you wouldn't plant in the front yard, but the hummingbirds have been at that and at the blazing star. So it's just magical.
And you're teaching a class at this event as well on photography, aren't you?
Yes. I wouldn't call it a class. I would call it garden photography, where we're going out and we'll talk about how to get the kind of picture you want in your garden.
Are there some tricks to it?
Well, there are. I mean, photography is light, and getting the right light, getting your camera set so you're capturing the light. Do you want depth of field? Do you not want depth of field? So there are things. It's mostly taking a lot of pictures and see the results, and, you know, taking a lot of different pictures at the same time. Now that you have digital photography, you know, my husband says, you're taking that like it's, you still have film in the camera. Take some more shots. So, you know, when I studied photography here at the university, you were in the dark room for hours and all of this kind of thing. And now it's digital and you can do it right on your computer. And, you know, so I can go out and take a couple hundred photos in an afternoon. So that's a lot to go through.
But it's fun.
Yes, it's great.
Molly Fifield-Murray, our guest today. Give us a call with your questions or comments as we talk with her about rain gardens and sustainable gardening with native plants. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show, and you can post a question or a comment. What native plants are probably especially beneficial, let's say, to the berries, butterflies, the birds, and the bees? Birds and the bees we can
right.
talk about.
Well, any of the native plants is going to be beneficial to some pollinator. And when you're thinking of butterflies, you're thinking of not only what nectar will they need, but also the larval food plants. So I think most people know about monarchs, and monarchs are not very numerous this year. And many of us have a great deal of concern about how they're going to get across Texas with its huge drought and
yeah.
its fires. And so I'd hate to be the last generation to see a monarch. So I would encourage people to plant native gardens that have things in bloom right now for the nectaring for the migrating monarchs. So that's things like sunflowers. They really like the tall sunflowers. They're mm-hmm. all over them when they're migrating. But, of course, you need milkweeds for monarchs, and you need things in the parsley family for swallowtails, and you need some maybe not-so-favorite plants for some of the other butterflies that you like prickly ash is a, mm-hmm. a larval food for some of the swallowtails, fritillaries on violets. So it's not just thinking about nectar plants. It's thinking about food plants, and that's why the natives, you know, you can plant salvia and get butterflies and hummingbirds, but they aren't providing the food for the larva.
Facebook comment from Bonnie. What's the best way to educate city officials about native plants and their many benefits? Many cities still use sort of an arbitrary height requirement. It's 9 inches here in Green Bay, and don't understand what people are doing with native plant gardens.
Well, of course, a perennial garden is more than 9 inches tall,
yeah.
too. And so the height requirement is a strange thing. And it comes, maybe from the early days of the movement to start native plants, where people were afraid, particularly of the native grasses for some reason. And they were afraid that you'd be raising vermin in the city. I'm not sure what vermin meant exactly, but I suppose mice and snakes and things. But so any perennial garden is taller than 9 inches. So I never have understood those height requirements, but I do respect some people's need for neatness.
Yeah.
And so Native gardening is not about letting the lawn go. It is an intentional garden effort to create a beautiful space using grasses and native wildflowers and trees and shrubs. It's I don't know how you explain it, but one way to get around it is just plant a perennial garden that's all native.
Yeah.
And, people are putting in ornamental grasses that are huge threats to our environment. The giant reed grass came in as an ornamental, and some of the other grasses that get used are just not ones we want in the environment. And they're no prettier than Indian grass or prairie drop seed. And prairie drop seed doesn't get more than 9 or 10 inches tall when it's in bloom, when it's such a delicate flower stalk that you'd never even think to measure it.
Lots of callers online. Let's go to Sue and Shano next. Sue, hello.
Hello. I'm very interested in your show. I listen to you every time I have a day off.
Thank you.
And about 6 years ago, I dug up all around the perimeter of my yard about a 4 or 5 foot bed, and I started with prairie flowers. And so I have sandy soil here, full sun. I have, right now it's fairly mature, quite a few different varieties. And I'm wondering, is this kind of like a rain garden, or is this just a prairie garden, would you say? Because everything seeps right through my sandy soil, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Rain gardens are intentionally excavated to a certain depth, a foot or so. I mean, they're not really deep, but you figure if you're doing a technical rain garden, you figure how many square feet of water you're trying to absorb coming off of the roof. And then you excavate, you test how quickly the water percolates in your soil, and then you excavate so that it's held long enough to infiltrate. A sand prairie garden acts as if it's a rain garden even without that, because, of course, the water going across it or landing on it is going to penetrate the soil. But it may not, if it's on a slope or something like that, it may not hold the water that's going past it. Off of a driveway or something. I would suspect a sandy rain garden with native plants, a sandy prairie garden will act as a rain garden even without being excavated, depending on its size.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, right now, this whole yard is flat. When I originally excavated this, I think we probably did dig down about a foot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So perhaps I already do have that. But I've got what you're talking about with wildlife and such. I always let the some of the wildflowers that feed themselves stay there because I like to feed the monarchs. And I've also got things, I've got planted lupins so that I can attract other butterflies. And I do leave my plants up the stems so that in the winter there's some interest and the birds can also still feed on the seeds that are out there.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. It sounds beautiful.
Thank you very much for calling, Sue. Appreciate your call. And I want to give Barbara a chance to in Brookfield. Barb, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a really unusual request. I am trying to establish a perennial garden around a grave site that I have 6 ancestors who are buried there. Okay. That's a beautiful cemetery in Milwaukee. And I know that if I don't get this established, it's going to be forgotten because the younger members of the family, you know, have moved to all areas of the country. So the requirement is that it can't be any taller than 12 inches because if it is, we can't read the names of the tombstones. We had to take things out because that's what had developed. And we started on this 3 years ago. We put daylilies in, and the daylilies have done all right. They have gotten larger, but they haven't done what I want them to do. And so there's so much here that this is, by the way, this is hot sun, and it does not get watered.
Okay.
And what kind of soil?
The soil seems, there seems, we prepared the soil the first time we used it, the first time we planted here, and we did put some sand and other things in there, and so it's pretty, when it's dry, if I try to do anything there when it's dry, I can't really move it, but when it's wet, it's workable.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to do a little quick aside here that a lot of the, in the early days of this native plant movement, a lot of the places we looked for native plants was old cemeteries.
No.
And okay. Frequently the people were buried before the land had been plowed, and so if you stopped mowing, they turned back into prairies.
Well, they're never going to stop mowing this. This is highly maintained.
No, I understand. I'm just saying it's an interesting circle.
Sidelight.
So,
right.
So there are many prairie plants that are low growing, typically not on really rich, heavy soil, more likely to be on sandy soil or gravelly soil, but you can still select them as the ones you want to use. There's something like Pennsylvania sedge that stays very low, is sort of grass-like, and you can interplant with wildflowers such as harebell and wild strawberry and pasque flowers, and even some of the things in the fall are going to be taller, but something like the gentians are not hugely tall, and if you didn't put them right next to the stone, they wouldn't be covering anything.
Uh-huh. Now, is there a website that I can go to locate these plants that you're talking about?
Well, there's a number of ways to do it. On the Arboretum's website, uwarboretum.org, there are lists of plants that are in our gardens. And so
you can
look at the sand prairie garden or the lime prairie garden, and those are going to be the shortest plants.
Okay.
You can also look at many of the nursery sites, like Prairie Nursery in Westfield or some of the ones in the Milwaukee area, look at their lists, and most of them will tell you how tall a plant is going to be and what kind of soil it wants.
Okay.
You can look at lists that describe, or you can think of a prairie you like to visit, like Chiwaukee Prairie, and you could just look at the plants.
Which prairie is it that I could look at?
Chiwaukee,
it's down between Racine and Chicago area. So it's still in Wisconsin, but almost not, and that has beautiful low-growing plants to look at.
How do you spell that? How do you spell that?
Chiwauk.
Okay.
E-E or something like that.
Okay. Waukee.
I didn't get the walk in there, but anyway, Chiwauk.
Okay.
And the other group to contact and look for lists is the Wild Ones, and they're online at 4-wild.org, and they have local groups. In fact, they have a seminar coming up in October. I don't know the date off the top of my head, but mid-October. They also have a gardening conference that's all day that you could attend if you wish, or at least go for a while and find the session that you would like.
Oh, great. You've given me so many ideas here that I didn't have before.
Good.
Well, good. And by the way, if you want to go to the Arboretum, if you're already on my Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show, there's a link right there. You can just click on it, and it'll take you right to the UW-Madison Arboretum, Barb, and anybody else for that matter. Thanks for calling. You can join into it, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Judy in Grafton, you're next. Hi.
Hi, Larry. So pleased to talk to you. I have a couple questions. The church that I belong to has a prairie, and the entire area actually around the church is, we're trying to keep in native plants. We have influx of thistle, and we want to get rid of it using, not going to Roundup, using some, you know, ecologically safe treatments. What would you suggest?
Is it Canada thistle?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you're going to have to pull it and dig it if you're not going to want to use herbicide. You know, talk to an old farmer around there and ask them how they used to get rid of it before we had herbicides.
Okay. It seems that when you dig it, I mean, we've been digging and digging, and we apparently there's always a little bit left, and it comes right back.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
What about salt?
That could be worse than the Roundup.
Yeah. Right. See, salt would damage the soil, and people use vinegar for herbicides, but it typically only kills the top of a plant.
Okay.
I mean, you can use boiling water, but you're only killing the top of a plant.
Okay.
I use boiling water for the cracks in my brick walk, for instance. But
we did that, too.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Yes.
For now. One other quick question. I had a buckthorn, a big group of it, and I cut it off, and now I have prickly ash galore there. Is that a native plant?
Prickly ash is a native plant, and it's also an important larval food for some of the important butterflies, but it is prickly.
Yeah.
For sure.
Very prickly. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm glad to know at least it's doing some good.
That's right.
Okay.
And the thistle, I mean, if you keep whacking them down, eventually they should burn up their food stores, I would think.
Yeah, you just have to keep after them. And sometimes digging is even worse than cutting off, because digging, you're disturbing the soil. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Keep at it. Thanks, Judy. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here. Larry Mueller with my guest, Molly Fifield-Murray, Outreach Programs Manager for the UW Arboretum in Madison. Here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking rain gardens and sustainable gardening with native plants today with Molly Fifield-Murray. Give us a call with your questions about native plants or maybe rain gardens. Comment on your own rain garden at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. An email from Toby in Cumberland wondering if you could suggest Wisconsin plant identification book or certain books, especially for native grass identification. But
well, the premier book on native grass identification for Wisconsin is by Norman Fassett, F-A-S-S-E-T-T, who was a botanist here and at the botany department, and he wrote a book, Wisconsin Grasses of Wisconsin. It's a technical book, as are most books about grasses.
Yeah.
But that's the best, most complete one on grasses in Wisconsin. There's a book put out by UW Stevens Point Herbarium on plants of native plants of Wisconsin, and that's a very nice book. There's a book about prairie plants of the Arboretum by Ted Cochran. That has the grasses that we have and the plants that we have at the Arboretum prairies, not the woodlands. And so that doesn't have everything in Wisconsin, but it has what we're growing in the Arboretum. A couple of the identification books that we used to recommend are out of print right now, so those are the ones that I know that are still in print.
On to Stephanie in Bear Creek. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to make a recommendation for the woman who previously called about the Canada thistle growing in her church's prairie.
Yes.
My husband and I have done a fairly large-scale prairie restoration, about 20 acres, and we've been at Canada thistle eradication for a number of years.
Yeah.
And what I really recommend, it's been very effective, and you do have to keep at it. You want to mow that Canada thistle when it first comes into bloom head. We live in central Wisconsin, and that's typically early July, like around the 4th of July. Just go out and mow it down, and then it will, depending on the year and the weather, it will frequently come back around this time of year and bloom again, and then you want to get it again before those seed heads, bloom out. And that's been very, very effective for us, so I hope that helps her.
Oh, thank you very much, Stephanie.
You.
Yeah, appreciate that call.
There's a couple of things that does is it prevents seed production, but of course plants are spending a lot of energy when they're producing flower heads and seeds, and so when you cut them right when they're doing that, you're sapping their energy even more than cutting them any other time.
Beverly in Rushford, Minnesota. On to you now. Hi, Bev.
Hi. I have planted last fall some low-growing fragrant sumac. It's on a steep hill, and it's facing east. It's a relatively mixed soil, but good soil. Things do grow there. And I'm wondering if it will spread and if it is a native.
There is a low-growing sumac that is native. I can't speak to the particular one you're talking about. The sumacs all spread, and I tend not to personally recommend shrubs as slope-holding plants because they tend to shade the lower part of the ground, and their roots don't cover everything, and so I prefer a mixture of herbaceous plants for soil holding, but they should spread. The low-growing sumacs tend to form a colony that's fairly thick.
Do they need a lot of tending to while they're getting going?
Not in my experience, but every place is different. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Bonnie sent us a Facebook note and posted the link to the October 15th conference in Milwaukee. So that's good. Featured speaker, Doug Dalamy, author of Bringing Nature Home. So that's on October 15th. And just for more, go to the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Just click on it. Click on that link and you'll go right to that information.
Yes, we had Doug last year at our conference. He's a wonderful speaker and his book is very, very important for understanding the whole system of native plants and native animals and how they interact.
Let's turn to Rich in Cumberland, Wisconsin next. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
I was going to mention that a great resource for some honey plants is a book by Frank Pellett. He worked for USDA 80, 90 years ago. It's called Honey Plants of America. And I'm sure most of the plants are probably native, but it's really quite thorough. And I use it as reference a lot.
What's the name of it again?
Honey Plants of America by Frank Pellett. He's one of the granddaddies of the beekeeping industry and done a lot of work with honeybees and for USDA way back when.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And another comment, too. I've been out harvesting my honey, and I've noticed that the monarch caterpillars are just now beginning to make their cocoons, and it seems kind of late to me.
And it is kind of late, isn't it, Molly?
It's been a strange year. You know, we've had two strange years. Last year was so far ahead of things, almost 4 weeks ahead most of the year, and this year has been behind. We had that very wet spring, which is hard on all of the butterflies. And we also have caterpillars that have not even cocooned yet, and they're still eating on the marsh milkweeds particular.
Yeah.
We just have to hope that there's not an early frost and they have time to finish up.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. Andy in Oconomowoc, it's on to you now. Hi, Andy.
Oh, hi. Well, I appreciate you taking my call. So I have a beautiful old property in Oconomowoc, and I have a little creek that runs through. It's very natural, and then it dumps into the Oconomowoc Lake. And alongside the creek, I have so many natural plantings from marsh to like a primrose, iris. I've introduced some Joe Pye weed, bugbane, some other things. But I have what I guess I would call it a fescue grass that just absolutely seems to be, taking over. I've been here 10 years, and I don't ever remember it quite this established. So what do I do with this?
Well, I would find out what grass it is for sure.
Okay.
Take a sample to the local extension or to the Retzer Nature Center nearby.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
And find out what it is for sure, and then you'll know better what to do about it. But if you have wildflowers mixed in, it's going to be a little bit tougher.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Gina in West Salem. Your turn. Hi, Gina.
Hi. We have a property in northern Wisconsin, and my grandmother always tries to plant the native transplant, like the black-eyed Susans and daisies, and on this hillside that's very rocky and sandy, and nothing ever stays. Wondering if there's something that we can put in there that will flourish and come back every year.
What part of northern Wisconsin? Because it's a pretty wide area.
It's in Minocqua.
Okay. Well, I would recommend a couple of things. One is getting plants from a local nursery or a local native wildflower grower. Becky Brown in a Washburn area has quite a nice selection of native plants for northern Wisconsin that would be worth considering.
Okay.
Sandy soils, even up there, can tolerate, would be useful to have something like Pennsylvania sedge, lupin, if it's sandy and open. Have you tried those and they haven't worked?
What was the Pennsylvania, what did you say?
Pennsylvania sedge or lupin.
Neither of those. Okay, we can try that.
Sandy soil is also good for the milkweeds, butterfly weed.
Oh, okay.
The harebell, wild strawberries for that matter. Assuming it's dry.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes, it is. Butterfly. Okay. My grandma loves butterflies, so that would be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Fran in Madison, you are next. Hi, Fran.
Good morning. I am wondering about mushrooms. All of a sudden, I have a bunch of them showing up on my lawn and in shady areas in the backyard. And so I'm wondering if I should do something about rebalancing the soil or if I should just pull them up and assume that it won't happen again.
Are mushrooms native plants? No, that's a joke. Sorry. Yeah, mushrooms are showing up because we had some rain. And so all of a sudden, the conditions are correct for them. The fall is a wonderful time to start to learn the mushrooms. And in fact, we have a class coming up at the Arboretum. Just happened to have one on getting to know fungi. And it's in later September. I'm looking for it. I'll find it in a second. Everything you wanted to know about fungi on September 25th, which is a Sunday, from 12:30 to 3:30. Well, so mushrooms in the lawn, I don't usually pull them up, but if you wanted to get rid of them, I find mushrooms quite fascinating, and there's so many different kinds.
Yeah.
If they're white ones, you want to be careful, because some white ones are very deadly. And you would not want to touch them and accidentally, suck on your finger or something. Or you don't want the dog to eat them if they're Amanita, white mushroom, the death angel. Mm-hmm. If they're just the common mushroom, the field mushroom, you buy it in the store. But I would not recommend trying it out if you don't know what you're doing. So if you want to get rid of them, just, they're the fruiting body of a... of the fungus, and just use a hoe or something and get rid of them.
Knock them off.
Also take the class, which sounds like a great idea. But
yeah.
I was just wondering if it said something about the soil. But I will just relax and enjoy it and assume that it's natural.
I would, it says something about the dampness.
Well,
the soil for
it's
one
the moisture,
thing.
And actually, it's not the soil. Well, it is the soil because it has to do with what's in the soil. But mushrooms are basically decomposers. If we remember fourth grade science. And so they are working on something, whether it's a tree root down there or the thatch from the lawn or something. Typically, you find mushrooms on woody, either right on the woody plants or out away from them, but they're actually working on decomposing something in the soil. But it's not necessarily a pH issue, if that's what you were thinking.
Yes.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Excuse me. Yeah, we were hiking a week or so ago in Peninsula State Park. It had been a kind of a wet time period, and the mushrooms and the lichen and such were just absolutely gorgeous, fun to see.
Oh, they're wonderful in the woods. You know, it's there's not a lot blooming in the woods like right now, although there are beautiful red seeds from Jack in the Pulpit and their blue seeds from blue cohosh and red seeds from gold thread and things like that. But the mushrooms, the orange mushrooms and the red and white ones and even the white ones are fascinating both in their colors and their shapes.
We have Barb in Milwaukee. Barbara, do you have a quick question?
Yes, I'm concerned about a lot of the evergreens in Milwaukee, like the rug juniper, some of the pine trees. A lot of the evergreens seem to be under stress. Some I don't know what they are. They have flat leaves. I think they're like cedar, and they grow like a poplar. A lot of the shrubs are dead.
Yeah, or dying. Okay.
Well, I just heard yesterday that many spruces are stressed in the Madison area, and I have not heard of an insect or a particular disease. We'd have to check with the extension to see what's happening in the area. The weather hasn't been the greatest, and some of those species are sort of marginal here anyway as far as tolerating the extremes of our weather. So some of them are just stressed right now and not necessarily completely dying. But I was told yesterday that many spruces seem to be dying, and I have not heard why.
Molly, thank you, Barb. Molly Fifield-Murray, our guest, Outreach Programs Manager for the UW Arboretum in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Happy to have you along here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller on this edition of Garden Talk. We're talking with Molly Fifield-Murray, Outreach Programs Manager for the UW Arboretum in Madison, visiting with her about rain gardens, sustainable gardening with native plants, and certainly looking forward to your questions and comments as we move along today. Join us at 800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Molly, I have a Facebook comment from Vicky. What's the best time of year to establish a rain garden? Is it best to dig the ground and, you know, let it overwinter prior to adding plants? Also, are there any current grant programs that assist homeowners with establishing them?
There are grant programs depending on where you are. So Madison has a grant program. You'll have to check your local area. You can establish them any time if you're using plugs or plants in pots. The most important thing is to prepare the soil well and control weeds ahead of time, and then plant your plants in. You don't want to do it too late in the fall, because plants that are planted late in the fall don't have a time for the roots to grab hold underground there, and they could be popped out by frost, sort of like a cork.
Yeah.
And so, you know, not much past mid-October for planting them, but you can certainly get the ground ready and then plant in the spring once the ground isn't too wet to work.
And she was also wondering about, well, other inexpensive ways to acquire plants. The initial investment of the plant seems like it could add up over in a hurry.
Yes, it can add up. Of course, rain gardens are not necessarily very huge gardens, but it can add up. So joining Wild Ones is a really nice way, because they frequently will exchange plants, or talking to your neighbors, see if they have plants in their perennial gardens that are natives and would work in the rain garden. But some of the species are sort of specialized, and you'll have to buy them at a plant sale or from a nursery.
We have Dave and Marinette up next with a question. Dave, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you.
Somebody is just talking about something about spruces dying, like spruce trees.
Yeah.
And my dad lives around La Crosse, Mississippi River area. And the Austrian pines we planted and these Colorado blue spruces seem to get a blight sometime after, you know, there's a lot of moisture and humidity around the early part of spring. And my dad uses beer, dish soap, and a water mixture, and he'll pour that over the trees and spray them. And that seems to make them come back, and they're all lush and green now. So I don't know what it does, but apparently it seems to help the spruces in these pine trees.
Huh. So a combination of soap and beer and water.
Well, whatever works.
Yeah.
You know, the spruce trees are not naturally adapted to this climate. And so they're going to struggle and things. Well, that I don't know what the spruce and the beer. I'd hate to waste too much beer on a spruce. You know, drink the beer and use the soap, maybe. Soaps are used quite a bit, mostly for insecticides, though, so I'm not quite sure what condition Dave's dad is dealing with. But if you have a sick tree, your best resource is the local extension people who will know what's going on. They will have gotten bulletins from the state on what diseases are or insects are in the state right now, and they'll be able to help you. They might not know home remedies like this, but soaps, you could, you know, ask them for or go online for natural remedies for some of these things.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. Lorraine in Holman. Let's go to you now. Hi, Lorraine.
Hello. I'm calling in regards to a comment that a previous guest had concerning the monarchs. In our yard, for many, many years, it's been illegal to pick the milkweed, and being that's their main source of food and protection for them. And this year, well, in the past couple of years, I've noticed as well that there aren't as many caterpillars around, and unfortunately, from what I gather for information, their wintering headquarters is being defoliated so badly that it's affecting them coming back to us. Right now, in a large vase on my back porch, I have three chrysalises, one of which I was able to witness forming about halfway through the process. And I just think it is the most wonderful gift of nature to see that metamorphosis happen.
Yes, and it's such a beautiful chrysalis. The caterpillars are interesting. Of course, the butterflies are wonderful, and we all have seen them and enjoy them. And I think there's many things affecting the monarchs, from my understanding. Some of it is what's happening in their wintering grounds in Mexico. Some of it has to do with farming practices now that have eliminated milkweeds along the edges of fields, and so there's fewer plants for them to eat, which makes it even more important for people who garden or even have a small out-of-the-way place to plant monarch waysides. There are a couple of nice websites for monarchs. There's Monarch Watch and there's the Monarch Wayside. They both have websites. People can tag monarchs, as silly as that seems. And monarchs from Wisconsin have been found at various places in Mexico. So it's you can follow the migrations on some of these websites. It's just a wonderful thing. And it certainly would be a hate to miss them in the spring. So hope we can find a way to get them across Texas and back.
Yes, and I was concerned, too, with them being very late in season, with them forming and hoping that the butterflies are going to make it.
That's right. But so people listening, if they don't have milkweed in their gardens or along the back, the you know, maybe the bike trails or someplace like that where milkweeds could be planted for next year, because if the the lower the numbers get, the fewer there are to come back. And so if we can help them build up the numbers while they're here, that it would be important.
Yes. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Lorraine, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, with your question or comment at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Open lines get you out pretty fast. Barb in McGuanago, you are next. Hi, Barb.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been kind of slowly transforming everything over to native, and one of the things I did this year was I took out European mountain ash and some euonymus burning bushes that we had planted because I read that those were becoming invasive in our forests. So I'm wondering if there's anything else. The other thing was Japanese barberry. But anyway, that's kind of my comment and my questions. And related to that is, you know, when are they going to start prohibiting the sale of some of these things that are really turning out to be very destructive?
Well, that's a touchy question, of course. The Wisconsin DNR has worked hard with the nursery trade to have them voluntarily restrict some of the species that they're planting But like I said, Norway maple is the most prevalent species planted as a tree in eastern North America, and it can become a pest, and it provides no services other than oxygen. So it's an issue that's threatens certain tradespeople who are growing the non-native species, but provides opportunity for people who are growing the native species. So some of them have been banned, and they work very hard to have voluntary banning. And, of course, the rest of us need to remove the ones that have started spreading already.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you,
and
Barb.
Then, I don't know, did she have a question on native woody plants?
One quick question. Is the Kentucky coffee tree native to Wisconsin, and should that be encouraged?
Well, it's not native to Wisconsin per se, particularly in your area, but the climate's changing, and it's native to the United States, Kentucky, of course. I'm not a purist in the fact that I tend in my mind at least to differentiate between things that are native just south of us not being as much of a concern to me as those who are native to Asia or Europe. I think they're less likely to become a pest, and as the climate changed, they would probably naturally be moving up anyway. So things like the tupelos and Kentucky coffee trees and Osage orange, some of those are things that are southern Illinois species that can grow here now.
Mm-hmm.
And can I ask one more? How about mock orange?
Mock orange, I don't believe, is a native species.
Right. So, and is that, does that tend to get aggressive in oak savanna type areas, or, you know, is it as bad as something like buckthorn?
Probably not as bad as buckthorn.
Well,
hardly anything is.
I have not heard of mock orange becoming a pest. The Wisconsin DNR Bureau of Endangered Resources does a nice job of listing potential threats and things that are becoming pests elsewhere, and that's a good place to look to see what's either here as a pest or what might be coming as a pest.
Great. And I think one of my rules is if anything says European, Chinese, Japanese, just don't buy it.
Right.
Don't put it in.
And another red flag should be spreads readily.
There you go. Thank you, Barb. Thank you very much for calling. Annette in River Falls has a comment or question. Hi, Annette.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest about the woodland violet. I haven't heard her mention it, and for me, it's been a joy. It creeped out of the woods, of course, and I've found that I have it in clumps in my hosta garden, and I don't think of it as an invasive, but I'd love to hear your opinion.
No, I wouldn't think of the woodland violet as an invasive. There are many species of violets native to Wisconsin, and there are very many that are native in woodland. So there's the yellow woodland violet, and there's small white ones. The common violet is what people usually object to having in their lawn. I'm not sure why, except that it's not grass, but it is green.
It's pretty, actually.
It's pretty. And some of the violets, as I said, are very important for some of their fritillaries. There's a study being done in southwest Dane County on the regal fritillary, which is an amazingly beautiful butterfly. And its larva only eats violets, usually the prairie violet or birdsfoot violet, but nonetheless, the violets have an important role. They have some amazing flowers and also some amazing seed production mechanisms that don't involve flowers. So,
mm-hmm. And at Olin Park, the woods at Olin Park, I'd love to go there in the spring. There you'll see spots where maybe a half acre or an acre will be all wood violets, and they're just beautiful.
They're beautiful, and you know, I think I've had jelly made from violet flowers, but I've never made it myself, so I'm not sure what that's like.
Yeah. Thanks, Annette. Thank you for calling. Katie in Elk Mound, it is your turn. Hi, Katie. Katie, are you there? Uh-oh. I wonder if we lost her. Yeah, must have lost her.
Well, let's speak to her question, though. But she has a milkweed overrun with larvae. Milkweeds have an amazing number of insects that live on them. And right now, there's the milkweed bug, two sizes of milkweed bug, the large and the small, and their larvae are on them. And then there's a kind of aphid, the oleander aphid, on milkweeds that's a little yellow aphid. It's quite fascinating. It doesn't need males, and it has live birth, and if you're looking at the aphids, look for the ladybugs nearby. Milkweeds just are a little ecosystem all on their own. They're just fascinating.
On to Brenda in New Berlin. Hi there, Brenda.
Hi. I have a question for you. I have two species of milkweed in my yard. I have the soft, the firmer, more velvety type, and that's doing quite well. And then I had swamp milkweed, which my butterflies seemed to prefer. And I was taking the pod heads when they would split open and putting them under the mulch. And then the next year I'd have more plants. This last year I gave all of my seed heads to friends and coworkers, and none of my swamp milkweed came back.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if it's an annual or a biannual. And then if so, I would caution people to, you know, continue to put the seeds under your mulch, because the only place I have it now is places that were unexpected, but none of it in my prairie.
Well, I thought it was a perennial, so I would have to look it up to find out why that happened. So I can't actually answer that question without some research.
Okay.
But I thought the milkweeds were perennial. Also, so
And it was actually like four different, I have like four different small prairies going on, and it disappeared. All the mature large rooted plants disappeared from all four areas, which is why I was wondering. It seemed by the second or third year they just all disappeared, so I'll be out collecting seeds.
Well, it may be something happened that swamp milkweed sometimes will grow in drier gardens and persist, but there may be something that's happening there that's causing rot of the root, or it's too dry for them, or some other condition. So I can't speak to it without actually delving into it some more.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Brenda. Thank you for calling. Catherine and Madison, on to you now. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, my reception just seems to have gone bad, so I hope you can hear me. I like the idea about planting natives by the bike paths, but here in Madison, most of the bike paths seem to just have Japanese knotweed and garlic mustard. And how do you get natives to compete with? I mean, there are people working on killing garlic mustard, which seems like a hopeless battle, but what about Japanese knotweed?
Japanese knotweed and Japanese hedge parsley and garlic mustard and Dame's rocket are the four main herbaceous pests along the bike trails here and in parts of the arboretum. It takes persistence. It takes some aggressive natives sometimes. It also, in some cases, takes the natural processes to help. So none of those do very well in fire, for instance, and it would be nice to be able to burn the edges of the bike trails, which, of course, are usually old railroads and were burned frequently on purpose by the railroad companies to keep them open, and that's what kept them with native plants. So some natural processes would help because these species are not adapted to fire. Otherwise, it's just a matter of working with getting rid of the non-natives and finding some aggressive natives to go in there that are maybe not well-loved either.
Can you suggest
Virginia creeper, for instance, is not beloved by many people, but it's an aggressive native vine that spreads across shady areas, and that's where the garlic mustard usually is. So,
yeah, and for the Japanese knotweed, which seems to be get some sun on the edges, it seems like. Are there any sunny ones that are equally aggressive?
Well, I would do prairie species,
okay.
Not just a single species. And I would think the grasses in particular would be good for competing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Talked about this earlier, but I want to go back to it. The Arboretum has its annual Native Gardening Conference coming up September 18th. This year's theme is Native by Design, Gardening for a Sustainable Future. Can you talk again about a review what we've got at that conference?
Well, we'll have two speakers. The keynote speaker is Evelyn Hayden, and she talks about eco-friendly gardening, having your garden both you helping the ecosystem by planting the correct or the most compatible plants, and then your garden working for you too. And we also have a session on permaculture, which is a concept of gardening that involves using everything that the garden produces, as well as invigorating the garden with what it produces. So it's sort of a mutually a nice circle mm-hmm. of how things work. So those are two really nice ones to talk about the sustainability. And then, of course, there's one we haven't mentioned on utilizing native trees and shrubs in the home landscape. And we've mentioned the sedges, but we also have one on ferns, which another group of plants that I tend to have to look up again every year. which one is this?
And so this is at the UW Arboretum, and it's on September 18th, and it runs all day, right?
It runs all day. You can sign up online, or you can print off the PDF online, which has the full schedule, and you can mail that in. I think it says a deadline of the 12th, but we'll probably extend that a couple of days if we still have openings.
And just go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. There's a link right there to the University of Wisconsin Arboretum, and you can go from there. I want to get Dennis from DePere on. Dennis, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. In regards to aggressive native prairie plants, Anacissip is one. We planted it a couple of years ago, and we are definitely fighting for control where we've been the little garden area we planted. We've got other areas we're planting and it's taken pretty well, and it's okay there, but we had one little native plant garden that we planted it in, and it likes to take control.
Yeah.
Yes, it's the hyssops, not just the anise hyssop, but the other ones as well are aggressive, and they're wonderful plants for pollinators, so they'll be covered yes. with bees and butterflies.
Yeah.
Yep, that's what ours are right now. They smell great.
Yes.
So, but you don't want all of them. You don't want the whole thing to be anise hyssop.
Correct.
hard to control that, though.
Well, you know, if you plant a good mixture of things, they'll work it out.
Okay. So, Dennis, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, the time has flown here. Molly, and nice things to see at the Arboretum, whether or not they can make the conference coming up on the 18th. There's plenty to do out there.
Oh, the prairie gardens and the prairies themselves are quite beautiful right now with sunflowers, goldenrods, which don't cause allergies, by the way. We didn't even get to that. And then the grasses, of course, turn red now. And then, of course, the fall colors will start in a few weeks and be spectacular.
It's always fun. And Molly, thank you so much. You'll come back again?
Oh, it's fun. Yes, I love it.
Molly Fifield-Murray is the Outreach Programs Manager for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. And it's great to have her along. And she'll be back, and we'll do this again. And check again our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you can click to the Arboretum and find out more about that conference on the 18th. Monday, we'll talk with Justin Doherty, the Associate Athletic Director at UW, about his book, What It Means to Be a Badger, and then Mad Dog and Merrill talk tailgating. Stay with us.